Good to see everyone out with us this morning. The singing sounded really loud and good, and appreciate his efforts this morning in leading us in those songs. I saved a quote a while back, and actually when I went and looked at it, it was about a year ago that I saved a quote that I thought, you know, was kind of interesting. And before I share the actual quote, I want to mention the author of the quote. His name is Marcus Aurelius. I don't know if anyone really is familiar with that name, but I follow a writer on Twitter, and he mentions him. He quotes this guy a lot. This isn't where I found him, but that really was about my only exposure or knowledge of who this person was. Well, Marcus was a Roman emperor who reigned from 161 to 180 A.D., and he is said to be the last emperor of, it's the Pax Romana. And the Pax Romana literally means Roman peace. It was a 200-year period where there was a lot of prosperity, there was relative peace and order, and it really was considered the golden age of the Roman Empire. That was around specifically when Christ was on the earth. It began with Caesar Augustus in 27 BC and ran to this 180 period when it ended kind of when Marcus Aurelius died. He was considered one of the last, he was considered the last of the five good emperors. And his death kind of marked the beginning of what they called the kingdom of gold to one that became a kingdom of iron and rust. And so he was the last really big emperor. Now, in the first century, after the church had been established, it was mostly local rulers and so forth that dealt with the Christian uprising, or however the Roman viewed it. But starting in the second century, it became something that the emperors themselves started to deal with. And the number and severity of the persecutions of Christians reached its climax with Marcus Aurelius. He was particularly known during the time that that this really kind of became very prevalent through, whether he was directly involved with it or not, but it was during his reign, and you know, people followed the direction of their leaders, and it was during his reign that these persecutions really picked up. Now, while researching the quote, I haven't forgot about the quote yet. The quote that I found by Marcus Aurelius is related to him. In addition to being an emperor, he is considered to be a Stoic philosopher, so far as some calling him just the philosopher. And so he's very highly regarded in that part of philosophy. There's a book called Meditations, which is a collection of his writings that is a significant source of the modern Stoic follower, the philosophy that people follow. And it is considered by many to be one of the greatest works of philosophy just in general. And his writings focused on self-restraint, duty, and respect for others. Now, if your memory is really good, back pre-COVID, I did a couple sermons where I talked first about the Epicureans, and then I actually did a sermon on the Stoics. And I'm not intending to re-preach that lesson, but I do want to highlight a little bit about the Stoics as we then have an understanding of the quote that I will eventually get to. Stoicism is a philosophy of personal ethics informed by its system of logic and its views of the natural world. According to its teachings, the path to happiness is found in accepting the moment as it presents itself. You don't allow yourself to be controlled by the desire for pleasure or fear or pain, but by using one's mind to understand the world and to do one's part in nature's plan, and by working together and treating others fairly and justly. Those aren't my words, that's a definition I found. Now, the Stoics are especially known for teaching that virtue is the only good, and that external things such as health, wealth, and pleasure are not good or bad in themselves, but have value as material upon which you can be virtuous, that you can build your virtue upon that. They also held that certain destructive emotions resulted from errors of judgment, thinking errors, and they believed people should aim to maintain a will which is in accordance with nature. Because of this, the Stoics thought the best indication of a person's philosophy was not what a person said, but how a person behaved. And to live a good life, they had to understand the natural order in the world, since they thought everything was rooted in nature. So with that very basic definition of Stoicism, I want to now feature the quote that I found. And the quote was, "Think of yourself as dead. You have lived your life. Now take what's left and live it properly." So I went looking for some thoughts on what people interpret this phrase to mean. Obviously, I had some thoughts about it that led me to want to do a lesson about it, but I was curious what people who really follow a Stoic lifestyle, what they felt. The first quote I found was, "In my opinion, he is saying that the immediate present is as good a time as any to start living a good, virtuous life for as long as you live without worrying about the past, which is dead and gone." I think another way to say this is, it's never too late to be what you might have been. Start today. I imagine that I die and all that I am is gone. All of my obligations and worries die with me. Then I come into being new and fresh. The problems that I have are no longer personally connected to me. They are just challenges that this person, who I happen to be, has. When my problems are no longer personally connected to me, they are significantly easier to handle. Sometimes I learn that they are made-up problems. Just my commentary. I mean, I wish everybody wishes you could put your past behind you, but it's not as simple as this person is making this quote out to be. And then the last one I want to feature is, I take him as basically meaning let go of the past. The past is like the dead you. It's over, so don't let it intrude on your living properly now. So, Stoicism and Christianity generally don't agree on much. There are some things, when I reviewed my lesson that I taught a couple years ago, there were some areas of basic agreement, but generally they are disparate, you know, trains of thought and philosophies. And I'm sure what Marcus wrote was not intended as a spiritual concept, but it is that last interpretation, the one there at the last bullet point, that is related to my immediate thought that I had through through the prism of Scripture. And so I want to take the last part of that quote. The past is like the dead you, it's over, so don't let it intrude on your living properly now. To me, this sounds a lot like what we read in Romans chapter 6. So starting in verse 6 of Romans chapter 6, "We know that our old self was crucified with him in order that the body of sin might be brought to nothing, so that we would no longer be enslaved to sin. For one who has died has been set free from sin. Now if we have died with Christ, we believe that we will also live with him. We know that Christ, being raised from the dead, will never die again. Death no longer has dominion over him. For the death he died to sin once for all, but the life he lives to God. So you also must consider yourselves dead to sin and alive to God in Christ Jesus. Let not sin, therefore, reign in your mortal body to make you obey its passions. Do not present your members to sin as instruments for unrighteousness, but present yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and your members to God as instruments for righteousness. For sin will have no dominion over you, since you are not under law, but under grace." I think it fits that last definition pretty well. The sin that you've had in your life when you've been buried in baptism is gone. That's the old self. And you shouldn't let your past hinder your spiritual well-being going forward. I think there are some parallels in these two thoughts. And at the beginning of Romans 6, Paul has explained that once we've done that, once we've become buried in baptism with Christ, we can't continue to live in sin. We have to put on a new self, because baptism symbolizes our death to the old life that we once had. And it's raising up into a new life of service towards God. Now, the rest of Romans 6 further goes on and explains this and highlights that thought. Paul's lesson is about saying no to sin. We were slaves to sin. We were under its power. We were under its control. And it enslaved us. But Jesus gives us new life. This is what Paul is talking about in our first verse, a couple verses here that we read in 6, verses 6 and 7. In verse 6, notice the end result of what God is doing for us. We would no longer be enslaved to the sin that our past self, to which it was enslaved. The rule of sin over us has been broken. Anyone who cares about your eternity, that's great news that we have that opportunity to break from the sin that used to be so in control of us. There are lots of ways to be slaves to this world. People are enslaved to sexual immorality. They're enslaved to alcohol. They're enslaved to their work. They're enslaved to the drive for money. They're enslaved to having the best and greatest new thing. They're enslaved to drugs, whether legal or illegal. There are a lot of different worldly things to which we can become enslaved. But our lives don't have to be that way, and we don't have to live a life of enslavement. So we need to look and see what Paul is saying. He's saying we crucify the old self with Jesus. We can go on the attack against the sin that used to control us, against the old life that we used to live, and against the sins that we used to commit. We kill that old way of life so that the new body might, or so that the old body of sin can be put away, can be brought to nothing. We can break this pattern, this body of sin, and we can definitely take control back, and we can break the power that it once had over our lives. And so, with this in mind, we can think we're not in a hopeless situation. There is a path out of the different sins that we've been enslaved to. And that's what Paul is telling us here in verse 6, that if we crucify the old self so that the body of sin might be brought to nothing, we would no longer be enslaved by it. We must see this as a positive thing, not as a negative thing. I'm sure we've all heard someone say, well, if I become a Christian, I can't do X anymore. I can't do this anymore. It's not really the way you should look at it. Crucifying the old self is not a, to put, it's, you know, not a wet blanket that you can't have fun anymore. But this is God's way of helping heal us and fix us. We talked recently, I think it was in John's class, about if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. That's what we need to be looking at. If that sin that was in our life is going to present a stumbling block from us from ever attaining our goal of heaven, then we need to allow that to be taken out of our lives. And God is offering us freedom from that enslavement to sin that we had. He's not trying to prevent us from enjoying life. He's just trying to prevent us and allow us to break from that sin that had been controlling us. And Paul's going to explain how in the next few verses. Verse 7, I put it there at the top, for one who has died has been set free from sin. Paul's not making a statement of the obvious that dead people don't sin. Paul is not saying that only when you are dead will you be free from sin's power. No, he's saying sin does not reign in us anymore, and that we reign in life. The previous verse, Paul had said we will no longer be enslaved to sin. And now the death that Paul has been speaking about is dying with Christ. If we look back at Romans 6, verse 5, which I didn't read, Paul taught that we must be united with Jesus in a death like this. When we died with Christ, we were set free from sin's power and rule. Not presented as a way, you know, do not sin. Rather, it's really a blessing. You could be set free from sin and don't have to be under its control anymore. We could die with Christ and be set free from our sin. As we get into verses 8 and 11, verse 8 kind of parallels what we just read in verse 5. When we crucify the old self, we put an end to the old manner of life, the old life that we used to lead. And we believe that we will also be made alive with him. Paul has used baptism to show that we are united with Jesus. What is happening with Jesus is also happening with us. But verse 8 is reminding us that this important connection that we have with Jesus, if we die with him, then we are united with him. If we die with him, we will live with him. And so Paul is really going to expand on this here as we go further. As we read this, it's important to realize that Paul is making this parallel. It's not an exact parallel, but it's a general parallel. Back in verse 4 of this chapter, Paul did a similar thing. He said, Jesus died, was buried, and then raised from the dead. The parallel is not that we physically die and that we are physically buried and are physically resurrected in verse 4, but baptism is the basis of the parallel that's being drawn here. We are joined with Jesus' death, his burial, and his resurrection when we die to sin, when we are buried in water, and then when we rise from the water in a newness of life. So Paul is making the parallel here with that. Death no longer has dominion over Christ. We know that Jesus rose from the dead, and Jesus' resurrection is his gaining control forever over sin and death, the power that it had over him. But what Paul is going to then talk about, we can learn further here in verse 10. The text does not say that Jesus died for sin. Jesus did die for sin, but that's not what Paul is saying here. He's saying that Jesus died to sin. He didn't live under the power of sin. Jesus, as we know, was perfect. He didn't have, you know, he was not enslaved himself to sin. He did not allow his body to come under that control, and he crucified himself to sin. The life he lives is for God, and God is the rule of his life. Jesus gave his life in submission to God, not to sin. Jesus followed the will of God, not his fleshly desires or his self-will. Because this is the example of Jesus, and we should be following it, we are to do the same according to what's found in verse 11. So you also must consider yourselves dead to sin and alive to God in Jesus Christ. We need to remember that sin is not to have control over our lives. Jesus died to the power of sin, and we must also die to the power of sin, because when we're buried with him, we're united with him. If we're joined with Christ, and since Christ died to sin, we also have to die to sin. We have to be dead in sin if we are truly to be joined with him and united with him. The first part of crucifying the old self so that this body of sin can be put to death is we have to think of ourselves as dead to sin. We have to realize that is our condition now. We can no longer live under sin's power. We can't live under sin's rule over us. We have a new master, and we are no longer, we're not giving our allegiance to sin any longer. And so if we can't realize that, if we can't have this thought in our head, then it's going to make it more difficult for us to put our body dead to sin. And secondly, we must think of ourselves as alive to God. We live for God through Jesus, who has set us free from sin. So really the fight begins with us mentally understanding these two concepts. And we have to have the determination that we are in this condition, that we are dead to sin and alive in Christ. It's a mental thing. Sin To be overcome, we have to be mentally aware of our situation. And we have to be able to be confident in that thought in order to not live for sin and then to live for God. Now, as we conclude in this passage in Romans 6, we're going to focus on the last three verses, 12 through 14. We can't let sin be in charge of our life. We can't let sin run our body. And so we must fight sin against... We must fight against sin taking over our life. Paul is revealing how easy it is for us to become enslaved to sin. Sin will make you obey it if we let it. We have already noted the many vices and sins. I mentioned some that we can be enslaved to in our lives and can cause us to become trapped in a life of sin. Don't let sin be in charge. But to do that, we have to deliberately resist the power that it has over our lives. We're not enslaved to sin any longer, but sin is still going to threaten us and tempt us. Just because we've decided that we're not going to sin anymore isn't going to change the world around us. There's still going to be many things that we'll be tempted to try, to do, to become involved with. But we have to be mentally strong, because if we allow sin to get back in our lives, then we're just putting ourselves right back into that slavery that we had to sin. And so breaking out of that slavery is very difficult, but as we've seen, it's very possible by dying to sin and living for Jesus. It's through the power of Jesus we have that possibility. We need to present ourselves to God, not to sin. Notice again that sin is personified. If we're presenting ourselves, usually you present yourself, and you know, we'd see in the Old Testament or whatever, people would present themselves to a king, or you know, we find in secular history, people would kneel down before a ruler of some sort. And so in that way, sin is being kind of transmogrified in that way. I don't know if that's the word I'm looking for, but it's like a master or a king that's ruling over us. And we shouldn't present ourselves to it, but we should be presenting ourselves to God. We're to be at God's command, you know, be following his commands, not sin's commands. And Paul calls for us to consider all the different parts of our body, the members of our body. Every body part is to be instruments for righteousness. And once again, what John had talked about, if your hand causes you to sin, or you know, whatever the case may be, but we should be thinking about how those different instruments are representing us. Are our tongues an instrument for righteousness or a weapon for unrighteousness? Are our eyes used for pure thoughts or impure thoughts? Do our ears listen to wholesome speech or crude speech? Do we use our hands as instruments for holiness, or do we use them for sin? Is our mind used for God's glory, or for selfish thoughts, or you know, thoughts that are just for our purposes? We are not to let any member of our body be given over to impurity. If we do, we're going to go right back into that slavery that we have when we are wrapped up in sin, and that it will be our master again. But when sin is our master, then we can't possibly be united or joined with Christ. Because when we join with Christ, we became dead to sin. It's not compatible to say that we are joined with Christ, but still serving sin. These two things don't work together. You can't serve two masters. We must consider ourselves dead to sin and let God rule in our lives. And that will help us overcome this. But as Paul wraps up here, this could be done, thankfully, because grace has come. Before Jesus came, the law showed us sin, made us its slave, and really, you know, there was no way for true forgiveness of sins under the old law. But Jesus now has come, and we are under the grace that he provides, meaning that we've been set free from that law. We can be free now from sin's slavery. Jesus has redeemed us and given us hope. And it makes it possible for us to leave sin's power and truly live for God and live under God's power. So, to paraphrase Marcus Aurelius's quote, "Your sinful life is past. Now live a new one, free from sin and dedicated to God." I know that's not what Marcus said, but that's really what I think we can take from that thought if we apply it to our spiritual lives. So a lot of this was presented this morning, speaking to those of us who have already decided to become a Christian and we've already dedicated our lives, to help us understand that if we truly are dedicated, we shouldn't be looking back. We should only be looking forward. Living for today is a Stoic philosophy, but that's really what we have to be dealing with. We can't let what we might have done in the past bog us down and have us still be overcome with guilt. If we have truly been baptized and become a Christian, we should realize that that's been blotted out, that we can live a new life going forward. And so that's what a lot of us, I was speaking about this morning. But if you're here this morning and you've never taken that step to become a Christian, well then, you're still a slave to sin. And being a slave to anything is not preferred. But slavery to sin will lead you to a final and an eternal punishment that from which you can't escape. You can escape the slavery of sin by coming forward today. You can confess that Jesus is the Lord. You can repent and indicate your intention to turn your life away, to become free from sin, and then be buried with Christ, as we found in Romans chapter 6. Be buried in burial in the water with him and arise a new resurrection of a new life. If you have the need of any of us this morning, we ask you now come forward as we stand and as we sing.